What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. Dr. Steve Hodges, pediatric urologist, talks about his new groundbreaking book, It's No Accident, Breakthrough Solutions to Your Child's Wedding, Constipation, UTIs, and Other Potty Problems. Dr. Hodges, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes, I look forward to talking with you. I found your book being with a real different twist. I thought it was very interesting, and I'm sure my listening audience will enjoy hearing about it. What was the basic premise when you decided to write this book?
So my office, my practice is about half of it's composed of what we call voiding dysfunction, mm-hmm. for kids with, colloquially speaking, say potty problems, wedding infections, bedwetting. And the parents would come in with very little understanding of what was going on. You know, they had these kids that were maybe, fine for years and all of a sudden having accidents or having infections. And there were really no resources available online or in the literature for that specific problem. There's a million potty training books, but really none on training or problems after training. And there was no good resources available for them. And they all came in with similar misconceptions and misunderstandings. Parents tend to get, frustrated or angry with kids if they have these accidents. So mm-hmm. wanted to provide some scientific basis for why these problems happen so parents could feel better, themselves with what was going on, and then also have some kind of framework with which to help their kids get better. And so that's the reason.
Okay. I'd like to start with some of the misconceptions that you may have encountered, because I think it would be helpful for our listening audience. Could you share some of the basic misconceptions or myths that you have encountered in dealing with parents?
Yeah, there's so many. Real common one is bedwetting. Mm-hmm. Everyone would come in with a bedwetting child having tried the same things. They've all tried making the kids sleep in regular underwear or whatever to get so they'd feel the wetness. They'd make the kid change their own sheets or something like that. Some parents would set an alarm clock every couple hours and try to wake up and wake the child. Mm-hmm. And invariably, those therapies fail. There's specific causes of bedwetting that we go over in the book, and those are much more effective. And we consider everybody that we have a pretty advanced society, but it seems like in a lot of these areas, people still try to use therapies that they think might work, that seem like they would work, but really aren't based in science. So bedwetting was a common one. Urinary tract infections is a huge one. Every kid that I would see with urinary tract infections would come in, mostly little girls, obviously, and they'd say, well, we've tried not doing bubble baths, and we've tried wiping back to front, and, we're still getting mm-hmm. them. And that is so far from the real causes of infections, it couldn't be, it's amazing that that's still passed on. And then a lot of times when kids were having accidents, parents would, and it was a common occurrence that children say they couldn't feel the accident coming on, so parents would either get angry at the children that they were being lazy or something like that, mm-hmm. or they would think the child had some kind of sensory processing disorder that led to the problem, and that's not the case either. And then all the way back to the beginning with potty training, there's a lot of push to train kids early and to mm-hmm. get them out of diapers, thinking that maybe sitting in wet diapers or diapers with poop in them, which I'll call it, is harming the children, when in fact getting out of diapers too soon may be more harmful. So those are all some of the things that that I see, and we cover a lot of that in the book.
Well, I want, even though this is a program about tweens and teens, I'd like to look at the potty training, because I know you mentioned in your book, your position is that we focus on potty training too early. And I think that has long-range ramifications. So can we explore that a little bit more? At what point do you feel parents should start potty training? Are there certain indices that we need to know about before we start it?
Yeah, so this is a really kind of charged subject, and people, we've done a couple of whale articles on this, and I had no idea it was such an emotionally charged issue, so people were very firm in their positions on this particular topic, and so I try not to be too dogmatic, but the data I have collected is clear, and I just want to stress that everything that's coming out of here, I get blamed for being like on the take for diaper companies or something. I have no interest other than preventing the problems I see in my office, and mm-hmm. want to make that clear. So what we see is that the kids don't have really the mental ability or capacity or physical ability to really understand what's going on with toilet training until they're about three. I mean, you can train kids a lot younger, but we make a big point in the book that it's very different to teach a kid to hold their pee or poop or not go in the diaper. Mm-hmm. That's very different than actually training a child to go mm-hmm. at appropriate intervals, you know, and to empty the bladder on when nature calls, which most kids don't do. The big problem with early training is that kids will not go on time, and if you read the book, you'll see that basically delayed peeing and pooping is the number one cause of all the problems that we see. Now, what's made this very confusing is that there is a lot of research in the scientific literature showing that late training is associated with more accidents. And I was seeing this trend in my office that the kids that would have the worst issues were the kids that trained the earliest, and so therefore for the longest time have been deciding when to go to the bathroom. And so I decided to do a study because all the studies that I mentioned previously were out there. And I collected data and actually saw very similar findings. I saw that if you trained really early, you know, before two mostly, or really late, after three or so, that you had higher issues of incontinence. So mm-hmm. what science has actually done is said, well, there's a magic window for training in between there, and that's when you should train them. That makes zero physiologic sense if you understand how the bladder mm-hmm. works. So I looked a little deeper, and what we found was almost always, if you had a kid that trained very late, they were having difficulty training because they had missed constipation. And so those kids get lumped in the late training with bladder accidents or bladder of activity group, and so it fudges the numbers. So if we look back at our kids and the kids that trained really early, with or without constipation, had problems, then the kids that trained late, if you took out the kids that had any signs of constipation, and as we discussed in the book, we don't necessarily mean rare stooling, we mean mm-hmm. large bowel movements or difficulty with bowel movements, then it erased the difference so that the kids that trained late actually did better. So it's a tough study to do because the only way you could really prove that is to go and prospectively x-ray all kids that were training, and I don't think we can do that. So what we've done, and we haven't published this yet, is just gone back and talked to the parents of the kids that had accidents that trained late and found that they either trained late and were constipated or tried to train early and couldn't because they were constipated and ended up training late as a result. So it's complicated, but in general, I like to think of it this way. What other activities do you put solely under a child's that's 2 years old's control? None, right? You don't let them pick their food. You don't let them mm-hmm. pick their clothes. So letting them decide when to go to the bathroom is, I think, is quite a big responsibility.
Did you recognize or identify any differences when it comes to potty training and gender? Because that's something I've always heard, you know, as far as whether boys or girls are easier.
I have not, but what I have noticed is that and this is the area of my research right now, is that there's very strong genetic and personal distinctions in the propensity to constipation. So you have a kid that's on, typically if you're on breast milk or a formula, the poops are, you know, very mushy and soft. There's no problem. But in kids that are prone to constipation, you can have firming of the bowel movements as early as when you add rice cereal and definitely when you add mm-hmm. whole milk. So you can tease out the kids, almost always the kids that ended up having problems, if you look back, and this is not very scientific, this is me kind of asking moms now, but it makes sense to me according to my theories, is you ask back, okay, when you change diet at about 8 or 10 months, did you notice the bowel movements getting harder or whatever? And almost always the answer is yes. So this constipation, or what we call rectal distension in the book that we'll probably talk about later, you can see in the book, probably comes on very early. And this behavior, this holding behavior, where the child maybe doesn't want to let out their bowel movements because they're painful, can happen mm-hmm. very early. And simple, you know, human behavior, something hurts, you're not going to want to do it, and that can lead to a cycle of bad events. So that's why it's real important if you have a child with that, and almost always if you ask those parents, they had it too, you know, mm-hmm. 'cause it's passed on, that you aggressively treat that early on.
What is causing the constipation?
That's a good question. So why they get... I used to... I mean, in the book we cover, you know, diet, right?
Right.
The Western diet is mm-hmm. bad. It's mm-hmm. a lot of processed food. And that's not good. It's a very low-fiber diet. And there's also an epidemic with the lack of activity and obesity in the country, and that can't help. but I've seen so many kids with good diets and, you know, good families to get... Mm-hmm. I think the number one cause is genetic propensity is what I'm seeing, you know, how prone you are. And then also the personality child in terms of, you know, you hear the old anal retentive personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
The kid learns that they, if it hurts and they can, and they if they hold it in, it doesn't hurt, then they're more likely to do that. And I see that a lot in terms of, I don't know much about psychology, but I think I'm going to try to start learning some more about it just so I can tie it in. What I can't answer, you know, because it's getting worse and worse, is what happened in the old days, right? Because in the 30s, 50s, 60s, I guess people were trained earlier, so you would think
mm-hmm.
the problem would have been worse. And I don't know what problem. I have a couple of theories. One, maybe these issues are so taboo, people didn't talk about them back then. You know, now people more, even now people won't talk about them, but maybe they're more prone to now. And also, I remember, you know, kids were on regular castor oil and stuff back then. They used to take some preventative measures in the days before Miralax. It would give these kids these things because I think it was a problem at that time as well. They just took care of it different ways. So it's multifactorial for sure. It's genetics, it's environment, it's diet and exercise. And I think one main thing, we have a contributor in the book that's real interest to your authors, Tom Keating from Project Clean,
mm-hmm.
and he talks about the third E of childhood health. You know, everyone focuses on eating.
Yeah.
And people focus on exercise, but mm-hmm. no one talks about elimination. If you really don't have all three, you're not having a healthy child.
Well, that's true. That's indeed the case. But I think society, I want to ask you, what role do you think society plays? Because we put so much emphasis on a child being potty trained. You know, there's some schools that won't even admit them into the preschool if they aren't potty trained. And so it seems like being potty trained before three, which is not the ideal time, you know, creates a problem. So do you see that society plays a role in this at all?
Oh, I definitely, and it makes me really angry because, you know, and I don't think anyone out there is trying to hurt kids.
No.
They just don't understand what kind of problems this can cause. And so if you recall the story of the young girl in the book, I mean, this can really ruin lives and cost, you know, tons of money to the healthcare system. So that's what I'm trying to do with, like, your program and other publicity events for the book, is get the word out so that people can understand that if you have a child that's forced to train too early, they can have medical problems from that,
mm-hmm.
and then those medical problems can cause worse problems later on. So if people knew that, then they would be, I think all teachers inherently want to help kids. That's why they're in the job. So if they really understood the risks, they would be more lenient. We see that preschools and camps kind of force parents to train early. We see elementary schools have restricted bathroom access for the children, and then we see older schools have dirty or dangerous or scary restrooms. And so there's no real emphasis in our society, and I didn't really, you know, intend to become like an apostle for this cause, but I guess somebody has to do it. And I see all the time, and this is an extreme example, but for me it makes sense. Kids will come to my office and be like, well, you know, I have this problem, but the school's having trouble letting me go to the bathroom. And I understand that they want to run school and it's hard to do that and
mm-hmm.
you want to keep it orderly. But what other medical problem would the school not accommodate? You know what I mean? Think about, like, if a child had a wheelchair. I mean, you have to have ramps for him. If a child had diabetes, you have to give him insulin. But if these toileting problems are almost treated like non-medical
Like it's a behavior problem.
Yeah, they're treated as behavior problems if they're not helped. So
right.
if we can do anything to increase that awareness, I think we're doing kids a service. And, you know, you hear about, well, in Europe they train early and they don't have these issues. I get a lot of emails from Europe, so I think the incidence of these problems is much higher. And actually, in England, I know...
Can I ask you just to hold your thoughts for one second? We're going to take a brief break, but I'll get right back with you. Steve J. Hodges, M.D., is a licensed, certified pediatric urologist and associate professor of pediatric urology at Wake Forest University School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He's an authority on wedding issues and the author of numerous papers, reviewed journal articles. He offers a wealth of knowledge on breakthrough solutions with your child and wedding and constipation issues that may arise. Dr. Hodges, I had to interrupt you right before we went on break, and you were talking about what we see in other countries, what we're seeing in England, if we're seeing the same types of problems. Would you like to continue, please?
Oh, yeah, there was actually people always state that there's less issues in those countries, and talking to some parents that I get emails from, it seems like the issues are there, they're just less discussed. In England, where they have a very progressive view, in some meetings that I've been to for the International Continence Society, they actually have a nationwide effort to make sure there's a bathroom in every classroom because they understand the importance for schools to have easy access to a bathroom. So I think this is a worldwide problem, and even though some people may not discuss it, it's definitely everywhere.
Now, let's look at bedwetting. And so often we think of bedwetting with the preschoolers. But we see bedwetting in teens, in tweens. I mean, even some adults have problems with bedwetting. What are some of the causes of bedwetting?
Okay, this is a topic that's I'm very passionate about because I think there's a huge level of misunderstanding.
Okay.
And there really shouldn't be because the data is clear. So there are three demonstrated causes of bedwetting.
Okay.
One is bladder overactivity. So your bladder is just kind of contracting when you don't want it to. And the actual most common cause of that in kids, all kids, is constipation.
Mm-hmm.
Second cause is overproduction of urine at night. So you're making too much urine at night. And so there's some hormonal issues that may be involved. And the third is sleep arousal. So difficult, you know, different altered sleep patterns, and so it makes you wet the bed. If you think about it, though, if your bladder capacity is big enough, or if your bladder capacity is good enough and your bladder overactivity is minimized, then the other two are non-issues. You'd have to make huge amounts of urine.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to sleep really, you know, for hours and hours to have an accident if your bladder could hold enough. So what I see misunderstood is that people miss the bladder overactivity cause because they think their children aren't constipated. And what happened with us was that I was seeing a lot of kids with varying problems in terms of accidents and so on and so forth, and lots of them weren't getting better with the traditional methods that we use. So I was like, well, this is, you know, frustrating. What's going on here? And for various reasons that I explained in the book, I ended up getting some x-rays on kids instead of just asking the parents about the bowel issues. And what I found was that all the kids had obviously too much stool in the rectum or the end of the colon.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm no radiologist, but it was like blowing, it hits you right in the face. You can see it, it's obvious. And now I've gotten really good at reading x-rays. I can see it all the time. So I went to, I said, oh, well, here's a big issue. Because I started treating that, and everybody got better. Mm-hmm. I get bedwetters in there. I got a bedwetter in there, and you know, she was 12 years old. And I said, got her x-ray. She's full of poop. I go, here, take some Miralax. She got better in 2 weeks. She'd been wetting her entire life. Her dad comes back and says, that's so amazing. I called my neighbors because their daughter's in college. She went in the bed, and she got better in a week. Oh. So you have these kids that were like wetting their entire lives, and no one was looking. And so I went to write up the paper. I said, look at me. I'm a genius. I changed the world and all this stuff. And I went to write a paper, and I found the very first paper linking constipation to bedwetting written by Shauna Regan. It was from 1986. It's a long time ago. And the paper is entitled Constipation, a Commonly Unrecognized Cause of Enuresis. Hmm. And then I read it. I'd never read the paper before, you know, and I'd seen it cited a million times as a cause, as a people stating that constipation caused bedwetting. And he was saying the same exact thing I was saying. He was diagnosing constipation in kids by looking for it, not just asking if they're pooping. And he had 86% cure rate. And he's published a series of papers on this with bedwetting, daytime accidents, infections. It was completely misunderstood by a simple semantic misunderstanding that people thought he meant hard or rare bowel movements. And it's not what he meant at all.
I hate to interrupt you, but that leads to what I want to ask you to make sure you include. What is constipation? Because so often people think, just like you're saying, that it's hard bowel movements, they can't move at all. And kids can be constipated and have bowel movements, right?
Yeah, so I tried to explain this so many different ways. When we wrote our paper, as you recall, Regan's paper was called Constipation, a Commonly Unrecognized Cause of Enuresis. Mm-hmm. I called my paper Occult Megarectum, a Commonly Unrecognized Cause of Enuresis. And not to throw anybody off, but I was trying to think of the best medical term to describe the actual problem. Occult means it's hidden, no one knows about it, and megarectum means the rectum is dilated. And so what happens, we actually have on our website, itsnoaccident.net, my most recent blog, is the best analogy I can think of, and it's kind of ridiculous, but bear with me.
Okay.
So take a sock, right?
Okay.
And cut the hole off the bottom of it, too. So if you pass the ping pong ball through, you could pop a ping pong ball at the bottom.
Okay.
And so take a ping pong ball and put it in the top, and then kind of massage it on down and out the bottom. That's how an adult poops, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you get, there's no, why wouldn't you? You got to go to the bathroom, you go. There's no, you have your own schedule, you can do whatever you want, and you have no, you know, you're not thinking about it other than that. It's usually a good part of our day, as opposed to kids. So a kid does not want to go, right? So pass the ping pong ball in, but when it gets to the end, just stop it there, because they don't want to go, they delay it. So what ends up happening is more ping pong balls come down the track, less go out the bottom, daily, it builds up. What happens eventually? This entire sock is chock full of ping pong balls, and it gets to the point where you put one in the top, and one has to pop out the bottom, because there's no room for it to fit.
Right.
And that's basically what happens in kids. They have a colon full of stool, and the stretching of the stool of the rectum is what's causing the bladder symptoms. But if you look from the outside, you see poop coming out regularly and normally looking, remarkably normal appearing, so no one would know the difference unless you looked. And this is, I've gotten in, you know, arguments with other doctors about this. It's so frustrating that even papers written this year on bedwetting don't mention it. And it was proven 30 years ago, and this is a very important point. I'm not saying every kid has this.
Right.
Easily 80% of kids with bedwetting, this is a major contributing factor. And think of what the consequences of this are. If you don't address that, then what happens? You get put on medicines for bedwetting, so they could have side effects.
Crazy schedules and routines.
Yeah. Sometimes you get put on medicines that are diuretics, antidiuretics like ADH that can affect your sodium level. There's papers out there, just recently another one published, that sleep apnea can cause it, and so you need a tonsillectomy for bedwetting. So some of these kids are getting surgery for a problem that can be fixed with the Miralax. So it's important to at least look, and not only look, but somebody that knows what they're doing has to look at it, because I've had families all over the country send me x-rays, and you know, they basically had to twist the pediatrician's arm to get the x-ray done. And then they finally get the x-ray, and the pediatrician say, look, I told you it's normal, because the radiology report says normal x-ray.
Mm-hmm.
Because radiologists don't look at the amount of poop in an x-ray, because that's not pathologic.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sent it to me, and I'm like, and the entire child's pelvis is full of stool. So one thing to keep in mind is, and this is a little technical, but the very end of the colon, which is behind the bladder, is supposed to be about 2 centimeters wide. in kids. So your poop coming out should not be wider than 2 centimeters. And any poop stored in there should not be much wider than 2 centimeters.
Mm-hmm.
And we see in kids, you know, 8 to 10 centimeter wide rectum, and that's very abnormal. And so other than looking at the x-ray, the best way to know is how big the poops are. That's the single question that picks up most commonly in my clinic. If you come in and say, does your child have really big poops sometime? They're like, oh, yeah, huge. Mm-hmm. And that's a good sign because if they have a lot stored in there, they're going to let a lot out when they go.
Well, what about the other side? What about diarrhea? Are very soft poops?
Yeah, so sometimes you'll have children with bedwetting that have intermittent hard soft poop because they have so much poop built up there that they'll leak some water past.
Okay.
It's hard for the hard stuff to get through, so soft stuff will come through. So, and it makes me wonder, you know, speaking about older kids and adults, how much of these people with, you know, irritable bowel syndrome or all these other problems that really have vague causes or therapies, how many of them had these problems as children that were never addressed, so they had this kind of dilated colon that's never been looked at? You never know. So
that's just what I was getting ready to ask you in this conversation. And when we talk about irritable bowel syndrome and all of that, how much of that is tied into what you're talking about?
Yeah,
you
know, yeah, no,
all
and
these
and
things
kind of
that occur as adults, I mean, but it seems like they're problems that have evolved from when they were children that were never addressed. So consequently, now you see them as adults, and they're still having the same problem. But we call it something else, irritable bowel syndrome.
Exactly. And we have I just linked a paper to our website today that was recently published that showed that the rate of incontinence in adults, urge incontinence, not stress, because stress is more dealt with, you know, pregnancy and so forth, the rate of incontinence in adults, non-stress related, is much higher in kids that wet the bed than in adults that wet the bed as a child. So you can see this has long-lasting effects, and that's why when people say, this is not a medical problem, you know, I got interviewed for a paper in Canada, and it kind of frustrating because they interviewed me about my research, and then when they did the article, they called it a theory, which, fine, whatever, but usually when you prove something, it's not a theory anymore.
Yeah.
And then the interviewed another doctor said, well, you know, who knows, let's not medicalize bedwetting. It's not really a problem. The kids grow out of it. And that's really frustrating because I see kids all the time that maybe they started bedwetting at 4 or 5, and now they're having poop accidents, and they're 10, and they're wetting during the day. And if you addressed it when they were younger, they wouldn't have got there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that's trivial.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I'm so glad to hear you say that, especially for our parents of teens who are listening and educators and administrators who are listening to hear that this bedwetting in teens and tweens is something that really started earlier. Much
yeah,
more.
And, you know, we had a high success rate with just simple Miralax. You know, it turns out that a lot of the kids that have really large accumulation of stool need more than just a laxative by mouth. They need sometimes something from below, which no one likes. But in teenagers, maybe because their bladder is growing a little bit more, they do a lot better with just simple osmotic laxatives. So they have a very high cure rate. So if they are having bedwetting, very easy to cure. I've cured pretty much every teenage bedwetter that I've seen in the past 2 years with a combination of laxatives and, in the rare cases, a wetting alarm if they are still having problems after the laxatives.
Oh, wow. That's something to kind of crow about. That's great.
Yeah, they do great. So, if you know, but it's you try to take it, you know, step by step, what are the causes, and address each cause, and they do well. And I feel bad because a lot of kids, you know, suffer needlessly.
Exactly, especially when they get to that teen and tween age. It just limits their development, their socialization. They don't feel comfortable spending nights over friends' house. They don't like to go on camp outs. They don't like to enjoy a particular activity because they're concerned about, you know, having an accident.
Yeah, and if it was as simple as, you know, when I got it's a good story. There was a nurse in my office that I was sending a copy of my book to one of my professors out west, and she's there next to me at the post office, and she's like, oh, hey, is that going? Oh, what's that book about? And I said, oh, it's, you know, this book I wrote. And she's like, One-Eyed Daughter, What's the Bed? And they had a very good pediatrician, and they had been seeing the pediatrician every year, and they'd review all the new data on it. And she was 13, and like, you know, really getting annoying. I go, I guarantee she's constipated. And it's like, oh. She goes every day. I go, just do me a favor, get an x-ray. So I got an x-ray, and she had the classic findings. She was like being reliably dry in a week. And so that's great news that she got better, but the other flip side of the coin is that this research has been out there since the 80s, right? And I didn't know it either until I did my own research. And why it's not gotten publicized, I don't know, but it's a shame that she had to go through, you know, years. Dr. O'Regan, the guy that wrote the original paper, he cured his son at 4 and a half. So, you know, no one even treats bedwetting in four-year-olds, but he fixed it at four and a half with using enemas, which is aggressive, but that's mm-hmm. what works. So you have kids that that can be wetting for 7, 10 years, and that's a lot of laundry and missed sleepovers, and it mm-hmm. may have been unnecessary.
Well, why the reluctance? I mean, it makes a lot of sense. What you're saying, I don't understand the reluctance. I mean, the treatment is not invasive. You know, it's not anything that, that you know, they would be reluctant to engage in. I don't understand why. Why the medical profession.
There's a couple of theories. Because, again, I'm not saying that, like, there's...
I know you're not saying this is a cure-all.
I'm saying something that you could prove readily. Just get the x-ray. If I'm wrong, mm-hmm. I'm wrong. You know, but I guarantee if you get 10 x-rays in your next 10 bedwetters, you're going to be a believer. So I think there's a couple reasons. Number one is they have zero bowel symptoms. So you have a GI problem, gastrointestinal problem, mm-hmm. with urologic manifestations. So I literally, when I started this, finding it, I didn't know how to treat this stuff. I was, you know, because I'm a urologist. So I would send them to gastroenterology. They would send them right back saying the kid's fine. Mm. Follow me? Because if you had, the kid's bowel movements are normal. It took, mm-hmm. it was a big kind of epiphany moment. I was in a meeting with I got a meeting together with the physical therapist and the gastroenterologist, and we discussed the problem in kids, and I said, you know, this kid has real bad constipation, and they go, no, you're wrong, she's not constipated. They give the child actually like SITS markers, a little marker to see how fast they'd move through, and everything moved through. And I'm looking at the x-ray, and I'm like, oh my goodness, it's a definition problem. It's not constipation. It's how stretched the rectum is. So since you have this two different fields dealing with problems that they don't really understand, there's not a lot of progress there. And secondly, and I hate to say this, is that I think people have been doing this for so long, the way they've been doing it, to be told they've been doing it wrong is not really... I know we're scientists and we're supposed to like accept new science, but on something like this where it's just like maybe not considered a major health issue, mm-hmm. And it involves an x-ray, which no one likes getting x-rays, people have been very reluctant, and I get emails all the time from parents saying, you know, that I'm a quack, or that I, you know, you're getting bad advice from somebody, you've been fooled, and I don't understand why. Like you said, if I heard this, I'd be like, well, next 10 kids I see, I'm just going to get an x-ray and see, and then
right.
once you see it, you'll be a believer. So
right, so it's not like it's a moot issue. It's real clear once you get the x-ray.
And the other issue too is it's a little more complicated than just giving a little Miralax, right? You actually have to make sure the rectal distension is cured. So I think maybe sometimes people come in and they're like, okay, well, let's try this Hodges theory out and give them some Miralax, like, oh, they got diarrhea, but they're still wet in the bed. See,
mm-hmm.
it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
And so they never actually look to follow up to see. And I see that all the time. It's like, oh, my daughter was constipated and the doctor treated it and things didn't get better. I'm like, well, did they really treat it? Did they look? And like, no, but I had diarrhea. I'm like, well, that's,
mm-hmm.
I've had kids on years of Miralax and X-lax come in with new accidents, and I said, well, I don't know what's going on, but let's take a look. And you take a look, and they're full of stool. So you can never know unless you look. And people get mad that I order x-rays, but I think if you, an occasional plain abdominal film is very reasonable, and if you don't want to do that, you could do an ultrasound of the rectum. And if you don't want to do that, you could do anal manometry, but no one's going to want to do that if they can avoid it. So I think it's very reasonable, and glad you agree, and we can help spread the word to get the practice out there.
I found your book fascinating. I thought it was very interesting, and it made a lot of sense.
Great.
To me. So would you share your website again for my listening audience? Because I think that it can be very beneficial and can offer some advice.
Yeah, it's www.itsnoaccident.net.
Okay. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We are having a very informative discussion with Dr. Steve Hodges. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return momentarily. What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I just want to extend a real sincere thank you to Dr. Steve Hodges. He is sharing with us the basis for accidents. His new book is It's No Accident, Breakthrough Solutions to Your Child's Wedding, Constipation, UTIs, and Other Potty Problems. Dr. Hodges, I'd like to talk about UTIs, okay? We see them a lot. We seem to see them more in females than in males, and I'd like to have you talk about urinary tract infections.
Yeah, so this is another very misunderstood field. So almost always they're in girls. If you have a urinary tract infection in boys, there's almost always some kind of anatomic problem, urinary obstruction or urinary reflux. So it's worth evaluating closely, so you should see a urologist.
Okay.
Girls, because of the shorter urethra or the where they pee, it's they're more susceptible. But, you know, one of the most striking things, and going back for a second to the toilet training issue, do you know how many urinary tract infections I see in girls with normal anatomy prior to toilet training?
I have no idea. It must be a lot.
Zero.
Okay.
Never. And these are kids that are sitting in poop all day, right? Not all day, but, you know, they poop on themselves. So you've seen a little girl that's trying to change a diaper after they poop. There's poop everywhere.
It's all over.
That struck me as odd. And so but how many do I see in kids that are just trying to train or just trained? Through the roof.
Oh, really?
So that's a huge sign that this holding of urine is a big risk factor. So there's the way I think of it, and this is the best way I think about it, you need three things to cause an infection. You need a source of bacteria. They got to come from somewhere. In our case, they must always come from the bowel, the colon.
Okay.
You need a pathway for them to travel that's hospitable. You know, bacteria can't necessarily live that easily on skin always. And then you need, when they get into the bladder, they need to have time to grow. So let's take those one at a time.
Okay.
Number one is the source of bacteria. I saw the same thing. Every time I get a girl with infections, I get an x-ray, and I see the same thing I see in my bedwetters and my daytime wetters, a large accumulation of stool in the rectum, which is right close to the outlet, right to the anus.
Right.
So what is an 8-centimeter ball of stool full of?
You know,
bacteria. Exactly. And I looked back and I found a study from the 70s, I think, where they took animals and they just tightened off the rectum. Again, this is from reading O'Regan's papers. And they tightened off the outlet so they couldn't let the stool out. And they all got bacteria in their urine. Just from that accumulation of stool there. So that's a huge risk factor. And Dr. O'Regan was able to cure all girls with infections by simply treating the constipation. So that's a huge point. So number one, if you have a kid that every time this is a classic case that comes off, it's like every time we treat it, it comes right back. Every time we treat it, it comes right back. It's almost always being reseeded by that same bacteria. So you got to have the rectum cleaned out, and that can, you need aggressive therapy, and that ties into what we said about the bedwetting. They gotta make sure it's cleaned out, and that sometimes takes an x-ray. So once you got that cleaned out, so what about the pathway? So how's the bacteria going to climb from the bottom up into the urethra? So what I see in all these girls, we did a study, this is a really neat study we have almost ready to publish, is I see all these girls with infections, and when I examine them from below, they would always have urine and wetness and red skin all on their genitalia, if you follow me, where the skin folds are.
Okay.
Makes sense.
Okay.
And what would happen is little girls pee with their legs together because they have skinny jeans on or tights or whatever, and they don't want to pull them all the way down. So the urine hits the skin and comes backwards, and almost all of it goes back to the vagina.
Okay.
Vaginal void.
Yeah.
So then when they get up, it'll drip out, and they're always moist down there. The urine is very alkaline or skin irritant. Causes a contact dermatitis. The dermatitis changed the skin pH. So I started swabbing just the skin, outside the skin of these girls. And when the skin was red, it almost always grew E. coli or something like that.
Mm.
And when the skin was dry and clean, it grew skin bugs like staph and strep. And we know that once you're pubertal, you get less infections because of pH issues. And so pre-pubertal and post-menopausal have more infections. And so not only is the vagina the wrong pH, but then the skin becomes the wrong pH and more amenable. So it's very important that when they do urinate that they wipe really well, urinate with their legs apart. And I recommend in the book a lot of good wipes, diaper cream ointments, and baths, you know, vinegar baths and so forth, to treat that. Because it's a huge problem. And a lot of girls will come in with wetting, but all the wetting is just a little spotting in the underwear, and it comes from the same thing.
Okay.
And then finally, the most important thing, holding the urine.
Holding it.
Despite having skin irritation and other issues, such as constipation, before toilet training, the girls almost never come with infections unless they're actually altering their voiding pattern by holding their pee. So regular emptying of the bladder is very important. Because if you think about it, the bacteria are trying to climb in there and set up shop, and if you just kind of flush them out like the salmon trying to go upstream, mm-hmm. they can't get in the bladder, and it's much easier to prevent infections that way.
Let me ask
that
you.
As you'll notice, I didn't mention anything about how they wipe. I didn't mention anything about what they drink.
Right.
I didn't mention any of that, exactly.
Right. What about one thing you didn't mention, and I wanted to have you address with little girls, is taking baths versus showers. Does that make a difference?
Yeah, and that's a big thing. Everyone comes in saying, well, we don't know why we're having infections.
Mm-hmm.
We stop baths. And now, if you use an irritating soap, like a bowl bath or something that's – because mm-hmm. I always wonder why people are coming, I got an infection after a bowl bath. This is the thing – the way I think is that you can't just get an infection from a bowl bath. There has to be a cause. So what's the cause?
Right.
So just like the urine can cause skin irritation and raise the bacterial count, so can other skin irritants. Another skin irritant could be a bowl bath. So you do want to avoid any soaps or irritants that can alter the skin. But since they're voiding with their legs together and getting a lot of urine inside of them, I think it's much better to sit in a tub and get that stuff out.
Uh-huh.
Just don't use the irritating soaps. You can sit in an oatmeal bath, you can sit in a vinegar bath or baking soda bath, and just use mild soaps. And just soaking there is much better than a shower, especially if that skin is irritated and there's a lot of urine. And I tell parents to kind of spot check their daughters after they're voiding, you know, lay them down, frog leg, and just look in the area. Do you see urine? Do you smell it? If you smell it, I mean, something's wrong because you shouldn't smell it on a child that just voided.
So basically they need to stay clean and dry.
Exactly, clean and dry.
That's what I hear you saying.
Yep.
Okay, all right. And those myths, like wiping from the front to the back, that has nothing to do with it at all.
Yeah, you'll never convince people to not do that, but
right.
Yeah, it's not. You can do it all day. If you don't do the other stuff, you'll still have infection.
Okay. What about caffeine and soda? What influence do they have on UTIs?
Yeah, so caffeine is a bladder stimulant. So
mm-hmm.
if it, we generally say don't drink caffeine because if you have an overactive bladder, it may cause you to have a contraction when you don't, and then you're going to end up holding, and that's a bigger risk for infections. But you can, you know, I had some people say they were told not to drink anything red or something like that. No matter what you drink, it's coming out pee, you know.
Right.
So, although there are some things like acidic contents that can cause more bladder irritation,
mm-hmm.
and caffeine can make your bladder overactive. In general, those aren't causes of infections. So, but in general, you know, for general health, it's better to drink lots of water and low sugar beverages for the kids. But plenty of hydration is important. So I would never promote caffeine, but it's if you have infections and you just stop drinking caffeine, it's not going to cure them.
Well, let me ask you to address, I know you talked about this in your book, but could you briefly address the issue of painful urination and blood in the urination?
Yeah, so these are two interesting issues that we included them because they can be tied into constipation. This is always missed. Number one,
mm-hmm.
so dysuria is one of those problems in kids that I used to hate to see because I never knew how to fix it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Certain problems come in like, I hurt when I pee. Mm-hmm. You check them out, everything's normal. And you're like, just, you know, tincture of time, and you wait, and eventually it goes away. When I started getting these x-rays on all these kids, I would x-ray them, and I almost found always, you know, this constipation sign. And
mm-hmm.
it makes sense that this rectal stool could cause impingement on nerves and causes pain. So if you have that in boys, it's almost always constipation.
Okay.
Now, girls can have pain from urination from constipation, and they can also have kind of referred pain from irritation in the skin and the urethra that we
mm-hmm.
talked about
mm-hmm.
kind of previously. So you have to address all those issues. And there are some people that are very sensitive to highly acidic or spicy foods, and it may cause some burning with urination, but that's very rare. So I do think that there's many causes for dysuria, but you don't want to miss the constipation because you could be suffering needlessly again. Again, going back to your point, just a simple look and see, and if it's there, treat it, and you might get better. Now, blood in the urine is an interesting one because it can be very dangerous and not related to anything. It can be, it can be kidney disease. Mm-hmm. So we see blood in the urine a lot of time in kids, and we have to do, everyone has to get the same kind of algorithm, same workup, because you don't want to miss anything. But 99.9% of the time, in a kid with blood in the urine that has no other medical problems, they don't have blood pressure issues, they don't have swelling or edema, it's almost always not a severe issue. And a lot of times in young boys, you'll get a condition called urethrorrhagia. What that is right adolescence or pre-adolescence, they'll start urinating and they'll have blood at the very end of the stream.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know in urology that if you have blood at the end of the stream, it's coming from the bladder neck or the connection from the bladder and the urethra. And that is highly associated with this dysfunctional voiding, high pressure, holding a stool, holding a urine. And you can imagine, the simplistic way I think of it is you've got this developing prostate and this developing boy, and they have all this pressure there because maybe they're not going to the bathroom at the time, or they're constipated, and they burst a blood vessel, and they get this bleeding. Mm-hmm. So if you have that in a boy, and you've ruled out the other problems, then it's very important to address the same issues we've been discussing, because that can help alleviate the bleeding as well, much more rapidly than on its own.
Okay. Well, in these last few minutes, I'd love to talk about Chapter 7, and I love the topic, which was scary bathrooms, foolish rules, and other ways school can make a healthy kid sick. Talk about how schools make a healthy kid sick. The bathroom conditions are abominable. They're awful, usually.
I know. I've heard so many different stories about that, and it can be very bad. And I've had several kids that have had infections just from school. They were completely healthy kids, and they were limited from going to the bathroom and started getting infections. And so the policy, and I understand, none of us wants to get in a discussion with them. You can hear that. Sorry.
Yes.
None of us wants to get in a bat, to blame teachers for this in terms of, they're harming our kids because they're not doing it purposely.
No.
What we're saying is that they need to be aware that this can be a problem and address it in some kind of way. You can come up with some kind of system where kids can get adequate access to a bathroom. You can make sure the bathrooms are clean and safe. And just understand that if you don't do that, you can get kids sick. And this, we're not saying they're just going to have a cold. They could have problems that are going to need workup in medical care, in a doctor's office. Costs hundreds or thousands of dollars, and it's preventable. So that's why it's frustrating. And we touched on it a little earlier about how at different ages it's different issues, right?
Right.
And for the preschoolers, it's, you have to be out of diapers, so then they're forced to train too early.
Mm-hmm.
In elementary schools, we have certain bathroom breaks, and you can't go any other time. We all know that if you give a kid a bathroom break and they're playing with their friends, they may forget to go.
That's
right. So then when they want to go 5 minutes later, they're not allowed, and you get to the same holding. And then for the teenagers, you have, bathrooms can be scary places. They don't want to go in there. People pick on them. Mm-hmm. And if you meet a kid that likes to poop at school, I've never met one.
Mm-mm.
So that's and going back to my theory about how constipation develops, if you don't go on time, if you don't empty the assembly line when it gets to the end, things back up. And that's one of the big problems. So I don't think it's much to ask of society to create clean, safe, private restrooms for kids in school, and I think they'll learn a lot better too if they don't have that issue going on. And there's got to be a way we can handle that with all the disciplinary issues that are involved as well.
Mm-hmm. And another thing I think we need to emphasize is when these kids are holding poop, they're holding bacteria and waste in their body. This is something that the body wants to expel, and you're holding it in there.
And I think, and we talk about this, I compare it, why would humans have this problem, right? Why would this be a problem? And I think we're the only animal smart enough to think we should hold it, right? No other animal it would ever occur to a cat to not poop or a dog to not poop, right? They just go. But we've evolved a brain, unfortunately, that can work a way around it and not go. And that can lead to big problems. And that's another point I want to mention, that a lot of parents are reluctant to use laxatives because they're like, that's not natural or it's not... they're going to get addicted to it. It is much, much preferable to be on laxative even every day than to have a colon dilated 3, 4, 5 times its size because, that may not recover. Whereas if you, you know, osmotic laxative that just basically is a stool softener can make a child go more regularly, can make them get better nutrition because they're absorbing more food. So I don't want parents to be afraid of laxatives or x-rays, you know, needlessly. I mean, there's issues and concerns with all that stuff, but if you're followed by a good physician, they can take care of that and minimize that, and you can actually help your child by using them.
And as last minute, I just wanted to add, what about the changes in diet? Because it was fruit, for example, putting more fruit and more fiber in our diet. Would that aid?
Oh, for sure. You know, and I've gotten, my wife's a dietitian. She would laugh and roll her eyes if she knew I was giving dietary advice at all. Because I had the worst diet for the first 35 years of my life of anyone. Because I got kind of a sweet tooth. And now that I've read more about it and learned more about it via med school and residency and what I've done for this book, the negative effects of diet are so long-lasting, and they're really the biggest probably health concern in America, if you think about it. We've kind of licked most everything else. And if we ate correctly, we could minimize all the other major diseases. Sugar is a huge killer in terms of diabetes and heart disease and so forth.
Okay. We've run out of time.
Sorry.
I'm so sorry. Would you share your website right before we close one more time with my listening audience?
www.itsnoaccident.net.
All right. Dr. Hodges, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Your information was invaluable. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical engineer, Evan Rossi. Audio copies are available, and if you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have topic suggestions, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. That's 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen Podcast, log in wfsu.org.